This is a podcast from The Times. Go to thetimes.co.uk.
The Bugle, audio newspaper for a visual world.
Hello, Buglers, and welcome to issue 165 of the Bugle, audio newspaper for a visual world, for the week beginning Monday, the 22nd of August, 2011, with me, Andy Zaltzman, live in Edinburgh, Scotland, currently the city of 1,000 comedy geniuses, if the posters and brochures and newspapers are to be believed. And in New York City, it's the undisputed Sonny Liston of satire, the Joe Lewis of jokes, the Floyd Patterson of funnies, the Jack Dempsey of japes, the Max Schmeling of mirth, the Primo Carnera of premium quality quips, and the Gene Tunney of gee, that's funny. It's John, the sardine of inviolable justice, Oliver.
Hello, Andy. Hello, Buglers. And, well, welcome to any first-time Buglers who are here because they might have read the New York Times story on us earlier this week. Basically, the story was questioning how on earth Andy and I were able to get away with saying the things we did about Rupert Murdoch during the phone hacking scandal without this podcast being dissolved, which is a legitimate question. I'm guessing the truth is that he was never aware of it. But now that the story's in a newspaper that I'm guessing he reads cover to cover every day, I'm thinking there's an even smaller chance of us managing to not get fired now. So thanks very much, New York Times. Your trumpeting of this podcast may well turn into bugling the last post. I guess what I'm saying is, to our new listeners, hello and goodbye!
So this is Bugle 165, meaning there has now been one bugle for every time that Hitler clucks like a chicken at Neville Chamberlain during the Munich peace talks. And also one bugle for every metre that Eleanor Roosevelt flew when testing out the catapult for FDR's inauguration in 1933. He planned to become the first president to fly onto the inauguration podium from a catapult. But in the practice fling that he made Eleanor do, she overshot the podium and ended up in a duck pond shouting, "Some prick overtwanged me something rotten." As always, a section of the bugle is going straight in the bin. This week, shapes. You and your triangles, including how to make the most of a hypotenuse without offending friends and lovers. Could rectangles be carcinogenic? We investigate new research which suggests that cigarettes sold in circular packets are not only safe, but packed with vitamins. Hexagons ruined my marriage, a divorcee shocking tale of how an obsession with six-sided figures drove her husband to make unreasonable sexual demands. I just couldn't be the shape he wanted me to be. And we interview the de facto leader of the radicalist group Death to the Dodecahedron, Europe's most extreme geometrist terrorist organisation. All that's in the bin.
Top story this week, question mark! Well, Andy, if you live in America, it's hard to imagine that anything has happened in the world this week other than the Republican presidential candidates going to Iowa, stroking cows, clapping in time awkwardly while Mike Huckabee shreds out some licks on his bass guitar, and being forced to eat deep-fried butter on a stick. They did that, Andy. The Iowans did that. In their ongoing pursuit to lower the culinary bar for humanity, they invented deep-fried butter on a stick. That tightening in your chest right now might well be the beginnings of you experiencing a sympathy heart attack. With the advent of molecular gastronomy, with the pioneering chefs of El Bulli in Spain and Heston Blumenthal's Fat Duck in England, clearly the good people of Iowa State Fair have said, well, when everyone else yings, let us yang. Let us take food back to its elemental source. Something that isn't so much cuisine as it is a suicide attempt. It is, at the very least, tangible self-harm. But you know what? Credit to Iowa, Andy, because I think they may have finished what you can possibly fry now. When you are frying butter on a stick, let's not forget the stick, I just don't know if you have any more digestive mountains left to climb.
Have you tried this, John?
No, I haven't. It's really unbelievable. They basically literally put a stick of butter on a stick, wrap it in some kind of cinnamon batter, plunge it into fat, take it out, and then hand it to a child. And then I imagine, look away from the how much Medicare costs in America.
This is just like a very slow-acting bullet, essentially.
But incredibly, things have been happening that aren't a depressing dance of candidates pandering to their electorate 15 months away from the election that they wish to stand in. So, top story this week, Syria! And there have been some important developments in Syria over the last week. First, it seems the President Assad has turned up his batshit behaviour to MadCon 1 on the crazy scale. The Syrian army has been battering cities across the nation, with particular attention paid to the city of Hama. And that attention isn't making them feel special as much as it's making them feel fucking terrified. And the second and arguably more important development in terms of the future of Syria is that it seems the international community and Arab neighbours are going to stop putting on a pair of pirate's eye patches and turning two blind eyes to the horrors going on there.
It does seem at last that the international community has sprung into action on Syria like a coiled courgette, blasting out of its starting blocks like a pensioner suffering a major stroke at the start of a 100-metre race, charging out of the traps like a freshly dismembered greyhound after a rabbit, and shooting up the trouser leg of condemnation like a comatose ferret after an overdose of Mogadon. We are taking a stand, John, against Bashar al-Assad, an honours graduate from the University of Despotic C***ery. He's been clinging onto power like a drowning glutton clinging onto the Titanic's meat larder. But now, just 5 very short months after the uprising started, and after previously only having gone as far as to criticise Assad for being a little over-enthusiastic, the governments of America, Britain, France, Germany and Canada have called for him to go. Even Switzerland, John, has taken action.
Whoa.
Switzerland has recalled its ambassador and condemned the violence. Come on, Assad! The f***ing Swiss are prepared to get off their neutrally coloured backsides and call you out. They think you're worse than Hitler. Wake up and smell the coffee machine before it smashes you in the face.
It's true. Saudi Arabia's King Abdullah himself urged Damascus to stop the killing machine and the bloodshed before it's too late. And in terms of traditionally muted Saudi-Syrian relations, that isn't so much a slap to the face as it is a slap to the balls. Kuwait told Syria that the military option must be halted, and Bahrain called for a resort to reason. Even British Foreign Secretary William Hague said, "We must not watch in silence while hundreds are killed and thousands more detained and tortured," before saying, "Seriously, we should at least turn up the volume on the TV or something. Maybe turn on some loud music. I just don't want to sit here in silence anymore. The screaming makes me almost feel guilty about not doing anything. I can't do nothing in silence anymore. Although I think I could still do nothing to loud Lionel Richie music. Party, fiesta, forever, all night long, all night, all night, all night long, all night, all night."
John, was that your impression of William Hague doing an impression of Lionel Richie?
Yes.
Well, I think that's
how was
it? That's a landmark moment in comedy history.
Right. Yeah. 2 degrees of separation from the actual impression. That takes real skill.
I used to have a Lionel Richie joke.
Yeah. Do you want to do it?
Not really, John. It was awful. 11 years ago at the Comedy Zone. That was my banker. Mm-hmm. Dark days. Dark days for comedy. Anyway.
That was a banker in the sense that banking is healthy at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah.
That was a troubled bank.
It's always been the case, John, that international politics has been an intricate game of economic Jenga. The unending search for ethical loopholes and cover stories that offer a veneer of morality, governed by diplomatic practicality, commercial expediency, and interests so vested that they simultaneously wear a sleeveless T-shirt-style undershirt in the UK and a snooker-eligible waistcoat in the US. That is a joke about the various meanings of the word vest. Is this
well
on?
Done. Well done.
Is this on? It's been a long month. But at last, John, it's come down to not to a question of ethics, you know, of human rights, democracy, freedom, moral rectitude, or political principle. It's come down to basic calculation of whether the whole Middle East would go completely tits up. And when the moment arises to be appearing to take a principled stand, we all love to appear to take it. And this is that moment, John. This is the moment for us to appear to be giving a shit. And I hope the people of Syria are taking that to heart and gaining courage from our convictions. There are now over 2,000 dead in Assad's clampdown on the democracy fans in his country, and the international reaction has been largely akin to the reaction of someone sitting in a car next to a picnic site, seeing someone else's picnic being inconvenienced by a swarm of wasps, to say, that doesn't look much fun, let's go home and have lunch in front of the Gulf. And until now, the various United Nations irresolutions passed on Syria have been Irresolution 1643, which was, come on, oy vey. Oy vey, Assad. D. do we make ourselves clear? Followed by Irresolution 1644, which was, stop it now, you're putting us off our food. And more recently, Irresolution 1645, which was, oh, yes, Ad, you little rascal, stop being such a rotter. Why, I order, but logistically and financially and politically, I cannot. So we just kind of waited until it seems inevitable that he will finally be toppled. And then, bang, yes, the bastard has to go. We've acted like a school kid, waiting to see whether or not the other kids like Boney M before cracking into a full rendition of Brown Girl in the Ring. And if I'd been you, John, I'd have sung that.
I just, every day, Andy, I'm amazed by your restraint. It's just pure musical discipline. I don't have it.
But what options have been open to the West? Well, I've got the West's economic reserves here. So we're slightly hamstrung by that, frankly, and our military resources have stretched like a hippopotamus ballerina's leotard. And unless we can ask Gaddafi if he'll call a temporary cease being a c**t, and the Taliban if they'll treat themselves to a little holiday and some quality me time, and they have earned it after all, then really, there is absolutely f**k all we can do. Long live diplomacy. And it's amazing seeing the bravery of these people in Syria. And I've been asking my audience at my award-winning Edinburgh show, Bugle Show of the Fringe 2011, if they'd have the bravery to do the same. And almost no one seems to think that they would. And it kind of shows that we've been lucky in this country. We've not really been put in a life or death position of protest against the government in this country, at least not since 1939, when the government involved was the German government. So we should count our lucky stars, frankly.
More instability news now, and India. And India, Andy, is an emerging economic powerhouse with a long and proud history of being pushed around by the British. I'm not saying they liked being pushed around, I'm just saying they clearly didn't dislike being pushed around as much as we loved pushing them. And since our awkward breakup when they won custody of the railways that we forced them to build for themselves and we won custody of anything of value we could load onto a boat and sail back home with within 6 months, since that time, India has steadily and then steeply grown its economy to the point at which it's now a major international force. But, as Spider-Man nearly said, with great growth comes great irresponsibility. And India has become incredibly corrupt. I'm talking right up there with the greats, Andy. Italy, Russia, New Jersey. They're in the Corruption Hall of Fame now, India, and we all know how you get there. You have to earn it by bribing your way in. It's been estimated that India has lost more than $460 billion since independence because of corruption through tax evasion, companies and rich people illegally funneling wealth overseas, and good old-fashioned crime. And this is said to have dramatically widened inequality in India. This is a country with a serious poverty gap. You've basically got people living like unregulated Donald Trumps alongside people living in the kind of poverty that was supposed to have died out in the Middle Ages. India's recently been hit by a series of high-profile scandals, including a telecoms bribery scam that may have cost the government $39 billion, alleged financial malpractice in connection with the Delhi 2010 Commonwealth Games, where you may remember someone decided it would be a good idea to use a team of monkeys for security, and allegation that homes for war widows were diverted to civil servants. All this resentment came to a head on Tuesday of this week when the 74-year-old anti-corruption crusader Anna Hazare was arrested and taken to jail. He and at least 1,200 of his supporters were arrested just hours before he was due to begin his, and I quote, fast until death. And that is a different level of protest, Andy. That is not walking around with a placard and going inside when it rains. That's not even smashing up the city you live in what could be called a form of protest, but what could definitely be called an overt expression of arseholery. What happened was that after months of wrangling with protesters and activists led by Anna Hazare, the government had announced that they had produced a new piece of anti-corruption legislation called the Lokpal Bill. And the main problem is that the Prime Minister and senior judiciary will apparently not come under the remit of any new anti-corruption ombudsman. And that does seem like a problem, especially seeing as the index finger of corruption allegations are being quite demonstrably jabbed in their direction.
Yeah, corruption is so rife in India, John, that a recent survey revealed that 68% of all newborn babies had to bribe their mothers to be allowed out of the womb. That is how bad. And 100% of all Indian babies perform kickbacks in the womb as well. So this is... And I, you know, When I was in India earlier this year, John, I went into a restaurant, I had a meal, and then I reached a gentleman's agreement with the waiter that if I left some money on the table to the value of my meal, then I could leave without paying. And that just shows how deep this goes. I'm not really one to talk about corruption, John. All month, I've had people paying me £9 for a ticket for my show at the Stand 3 at 4:25pm. With a definite subtext, here you go, Treacle. Now make me laugh and it'll stay our little secret. And I admit I've caved in, John. I've caved in and my career has stayed mostly a secret.
The protester, 74-year-old Anna Hazare, has become a folk hero across India as the country becomes increasingly disgusted by the now record levels of corruption. And his calls for non-violent protest have led to him being called a modern-day Gandhi. And I don't know how happy he'll be to hear that, Andy. Not because he doesn't feel worthy to be compared to a man of such iconic status, but more because things didn't work out too great for Gandhi. If Hazare really is a modern-day Gandhi, he may soon be on the receiving end of a death sandwich. And not that that is something he would recoil from. He is, after all, planning to go on hunger strike, and he stated to the press, "It's time to do or die now, just like during our struggle for independence. Either we succeed in our mission, or we make the ultimate sacrifice." Hey, Hazare, let's not bring that independence shit up again, please. Let's all agree there was fault on both sides. That was a mutual decision to split up. That relationship had become untenable. Largely due to exactly that kind of holier-than-thou moralising. God, you're annoying when you're complaining.
Also, distance, you know. Distance is difficult in any relationship. And
very long distance.
We're a long way apart. I was in Delhi earlier this year and I was just having a drink with some Indian friends and we were next to a table full of English cricket fans from the Barmy Army, who are the non-violent, non-physically violent wing of extremist cricket support. But anyway, they like a drink, the Barmy Army, and they like a song. And I was sitting with this sort of five or six Indian guys, and the Barmy Army contingent struck into a rousing rendition of Jerusalem. And my Indian friends kind of shifted a little bit awkwardly. And at the end I said, "I'm sorry, gentlemen, was that a little too soon after independence?" And it's the joys of watching sport as an Englishman overseas.
Yeah.
The corruption is unbelievable in India, John. Basically, you get an Indian newspaper, and it's basically corruption news with a pull-out supplement of all other things in the world. And just at every level, local politics, regional politics, national politics, it's just completely everywhere. And, you know, they must look at our corruption scandals, you know, our MPs scandals and our phone hacking scandals, and just think, you people do not know you've been born. Unless it turns out that the Queen has been selling her eggs to the Soviet Union. We cannot touch these guys. They are the masters of it. By the end of... I spent 6 weeks in India. By the end, I was having to bribe myself to get up in the morning. That, it just gets into you.
Parking news now! And if you're ever in Lithuania's capital, Vilnius, then you may want to be careful where you park. And this should speak strongly to you specifically, Andy. Because aren't you descended from Lithuanian Jews?
I am, John. But as I recall from history, where to park was the least of their concerns.
Was it? Because didn't they actually have to leave in a way due to a parking violation, in that they had parked themselves in the country? Hadn't looked at the parking sign on the side of the road that said, no Jews Monday to Friday, 8 a.m. until 10 p.m.
Yeah.
They got ticketed, basically. Although, they got ticketed.
Yeah, although it then became no Jews 8 a.m. to 10 p.m. 1940 to the rest of time.
Oh, it's
glad you find it so funny, though, John. Good. Tragedy plus time.
Yeah.
Equals foot deal.
The point is, the mayor of Lithuania's capital, Vilnius, has been filmed using an armoured vehicle to crush a car parked illegally in a cycle lane. And if you watch the video, he's literally leaning out of the hatch on top of the armoured vehicle and beaming from ear to ear as it crushes the illegally parked Mercedes flat under its massive wheels. And in the video he says, "That's what will happen if you park your car illegally." I don't know if that was his attempt to sound like an action hero, whether that was his hasta la vista, baby, or go ahead, make my day. I think he was imagining himself in a leather jacket and sunglasses, leaning out of the tank with a model in a bikini on his arm, looking straight into the camera and saying, "That's what will happen if you park your car illegally," and then Slash appearing on the hood of the armoured car, playing the electric guitar as the mayor fires a rocket into the air. I think that's what he was thinking was going on.
Well, for too long, John, and we look at all the protests around the world, John. People want democracy, they want freedom, they want basic human rights, they want food, they want not to be shot by their governments. But above all, they want clear streets, John, free from illegally parked cars. And this guy, he's like a cross between Gandhi, Mandela and Mother Teresa, all rolled into one and turned into a Lithuanian man. He's a hero, John. He's like Jesus, but more so.
If you watch the video out, what happens is the mayor then sweeps up the broken glass from the shattered car windows, then has an extremely awkward conversation with the owner of the Mercedes, who turns up looking understandably confused. The mayor warns the car owner about the dangers of parking illegally, even though that's clearly a moot point now, as the car owner doesn't own a car anymore. He just owns a pile of crushed metal with his house keys in the crushed glove compartment. And finally, the mayor hops onto a bicycle and rides off. Now, what action hero has ever rode off on a bicycle at the end, Andy? Maybe that's what Lithuanian superheroes do. You would know better than me, Andy. Does Lithuanian Superman's powers involve not flying, but being able to cycle really fast? Can Lithuanian Spider-Man just cycle up the side of buildings? I don't know.
I think Lithuanian Spider-Man probably spends about 5 years in a cellar hoping for the best.
The mayor was quoted as saying, "You have to have a sense of humour in my line of work, and I thought that this would be a way of drawing attention to the fact that the city intends to be proactive in its fight against illegal parking." Now, if he's completely honest, Andy, he would then have said, "I also thought it would be a great way for me to crush a Mercedes with an armoured car. And it was just as cool as I thought it would be."
I want to see on the streets of South London when I get home after Edinburgh, I want to see a fleet of badonkadonk tanks clearing the streets of unregulated and illegally parked vehicles, John. This is the future of politics. And also, when he says you have to have a sense of humour in this job, he is, of course, 100% wrong. And in fact, generally in high political office, it's probably better not to have a sense of humour and to do your fucking job properly. Surrealism generally doesn't play well as a political tactic.
Something clearly isn't right with this story, Andy, because the BBC's Russian service reporter in Vilnius said that while Vilnius' central streets do indeed have strictly prohibited parking, illegal parking is not that big a problem in the city. So, illegal parking isn't even really a huge concern. This all smacks of a mayor who just really wanted to run over a car in an armoured vehicle. I'm guessing that's going to be his solution to a lot of things right now. I realise that the instability of the Eurozone and the failure of the European Central Bank to increase market confidence is causing widespread problems. And I thought a great way to deal with this would be if I drove this armoured car over the top of a small aeroplane. I also realise that Syria is teetering on the brink of revolution and President Assad's brutal crackdown of protesters is shocking the world. I thought it might help if I drive this armoured car over the top of a speedboat. It might not help, but it surely can't hurt. Slash, please turn up your guitar. Let's do this thing.
I hope he's... You just got a dog, haven't you, John?
Yeah.
Are you going to take the same approach to house training the dog? You know, any little unscheduled parcels deposited on the carpet, out comes the tank, squish. Oh, the little blighter's got to learn.
I can't joke about it, Andy. I love her too much.
You can joke about the annihilation of my people in the Second World War. You can't joke about your little puppy.
It's too raw, Andy. I just can see her little face looking up at me.
What's your puppy's name, John?
Hoagie.
Hoagie. It's important that we have names to these people.
Yeah.
And dogs.
Hoagie the dog.
Right. How's that going? Your first taste of parenthood?
Good. Good, yeah. Babies are a lot woofier than I thought they'd be. God news now! And a startling new poll has revealed that only just over half of Americans say they approve of God's job performance. Only 52% of voters, when asked, said they were very pleased with how God seemed to be handling the universe. when they were asked the question, if God exists, do you approve or disapprove of its performance? Its performance? Take that, God. Not only are you now only just keeping your head above a 50% approval rating, you're now an it. That's got to be a huge wake-up call for the big man, Andy, or the big it.
Well, what exactly has God been doing for the last 2,000 years? John sitting around on his big cloudy butt, doing pretty much jack shit as far as I can make out. And it does suggest that that's quite a high approval rating, John. That is more than any member of Congress, I think I read, and
that's
more
than
almost every political leader around the world, I would imagine. That suggests that taking a laissez-faire attitude is really guaranteed to get you elected, John. He would get under any electoral system, he would be in. And he has done nothing since allowing his own son to be killed. Now, is that really the kind of leadership we're looking for in the world? Maybe it is. I mean, I know he's had creative difficulties, John. His first book, of course, was overlong, convoluted, structurally flawed and rather episodic, lacking a coherent narrative. And the second one was basically a sci-fi fantasy whose central character was inherently unbelievable. So, you see, he's been struggling in terms of action and in terms of creativity. And I guess he can only rely for so long on the excuse, come on, I made a peacock. I'm not going to fly for that long, is it?
I don't know, Andy, how many peacocks have you made? I'm guessing it's less than one.
But also, Rupert Murdoch rates in the same poll 12% approval. So he's doing nearly as quarter as well as God, which, given the recent little bloopers he's been involved in, he should be quite pleased with that, I think.
Of those who voted, 40% said they were unsure of whether they approved or not, which is classic hedging of your bets. To be honest, very wise. And 9% said they did not approve. And those 9% are going to have trouble explaining that to St. Peter at the pearly gates eventually. Apparently, younger voters, aged 18 to 29, were much more likely to disapprove of God's works. And it's not clear whether that's because they have a bleaker future to look forward to planet-wise, or whether they are further away from God's damning judgment on their survey response. The 928 American voters, ranging from liberal to conservative, were asked to rate God's performance during the survey. And also in detail when it came to issues like creating the universe, handling the animal kingdom, and controlling natural disasters. And here are the results, Andy. When asked to evaluate God on some of the issues it is responsible for, voters gave God its best rating on creating the universe, 71 to 5. Now, they also apparently approved.
That means 5% of people disapprove of the creation of the universe, John. And I guess financially they might have a point, John. I mean, it's clearly a loss-making universe.
Right.
And bottom line,
good point.
We would all be better off if the universe didn't exist. And that really, in the modern world, that's all that counts. Bottom line, finance.
They also approve of God's handling of the animal kingdom, 56 to 11.
Really?
But even, this is the shocker, even God's handling of natural disasters, 50 to 13. What? They approve of God's handling of natural disasters. How about not having any? How about that? How about that as a suggestion? That smacks, Andy, of ballot box intimidation to me. I think you've got to get the UN involved here. I think people are worried that if they vote against him, they're going to have one of God's tornado goons come rough their town up overnight. But as you mentioned, this might actually not turn out to be that bad a score for God, because President Obama only has a 44% approval rating at the moment. It's the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, only has a 33% approval rating. And as you mentioned, the worst rating of all in this survey was reserved for Rupert Murdoch, who only had a 12% approval rating. Is this on? Is anyone still hearing this?
Well, most of those 12% were buglers who just want us to keep going, I think.
Yeah. But they all lag behind Oprah Winfrey, who had a 60% approval rating in a Fox News poll from this spring. That's right. Oprah Winfrey, Andy, has an 8-point lead on God in terms of popularity. And she doesn't even have her own show anymore. I guess it just goes to show, if you give out free shit, people will love you. But perhaps the best part of this whole story, Andy, was the fact, if you scroll down to the bottom of the poll, it states, this poll's margin of error was plus or minus 3.2%. Are you f***ing kidding me? I'm not... Let me be clear. I'm not an elite-level professional mathlete, Andy. And I've never claimed to be. But shouldn't the margin of error for that particular survey be, oh, I don't know, 100%? At the very least.
Of course, God's had a pretty up-and-down relationship with the human race for quite a while now. God, for those of you not heard of him, retired former celebrity planet designer, microbiologist and genocidal flood-wielding maniac, who lists among his many addresses the Vatican City, bits of the Middle East and every grain of sand. He sounds like a f***ing tax dodger to me, John. But ever since the series of 10 increasingly annoying pranks against Egypt, ah, locusts everywhere, ah, that'll teach you to enslave my buddies, ah, frogs, ah. Well, he's, you know, I think he's off his game, John. He's lazy and self-interested and off his game. And if that is wrong, Lord, strike me down now. Well, if Murdoch's not going to do it, I don't think God is either. Quick riots update, and I'm reporting to you from the gloriously rebuilt utopia of Britain, where the riots of a week ago are now little more than a shared communal memory of an age of gloom, violence and lawlessness, as peace between Britain and itself has held for days. We must be the greatest country in the world, John, to reunify ourselves so swiftly after a civil war, albeit a civil war between a small subsection of Britain and the concept of paying for stuff. As a result of the riots, the prison population here has hit a record high of 86,600 due to some pretty hasty sentencing. And a common complaint about our prisons, John, is that people say our prisons are like five-star hotels. And I guess they are like five-star hotels in that they seem to be specifically designed to do absolutely everything in their power to ensure their guests come back for another stay. And there's been some pretty harsh sentencing. One guy got 6 months for stealing £3.50 worth of water, 18 months for handling a stolen television. That's significantly sterner if they'd committed the same offence in peacetime rather than during the Civil War. And it's just a further sign of Britain getting medieval with itself. Of course, these sentences do diverge significantly from the penalties for white-collar looting, or corporate tax evasion, as it's commonly known, the penalties for which are, from memory, a knighthood and behind-the-scenes influence with the cabinet. So you can see why some of these sentences have riled some people. Although, you know, tough times, tough measures, John, that's the government's mantra. Tough times, tough measures. String them up. String them all up. And keep waggling the string. Your emails now, and we've talked too long, and we're about to get kicked out of the... Well, I'm about to get kicked out of the studio in Edinburgh, so we don't have time for your emails. There's a couple of very good pictures of them being sent in that I will post on the at Hello Buglers Twitter feed, and do keep them coming in, and we'll do some more next week. What's the email says? TheBugle@timesonline.co.uk. It's been a long month.
How long has it been, Andy?
What, this month? Yeah. It's half a month. 2/3 of a month, nearly. But my kids have been... we've been sleeping four in a room for the last week. Oof. And my kids...
Oh, boy.
I've got a show that... My political animal show finishes at 2 in the morning. And my kids do not factor that into when they f***ing wake up. So... I'm running a little bit tired. But there you go. So, now, John, this coming week, you are coming to Edinburgh.
I am coming to Edinburgh, as like Eddie Murphy so nearly did. Except he went to America. I'm coming back to Edinburgh, like a non-monarch returning to the city that was indifferent to him in his time there.
So we'll be recording next week's Bugle in the same room. That very rare occurrence.
Very
the
strange.
Rarest of bugles. It's happened two or three times before. But
let's hope it doesn't turn into a fist fight.
Yeah, well, you can't rule that out. And also, next week's political animal gigs, Tuesday, Wednesday and Thursday's gigs, John will be on. We will be seeing if it still works after 5 years.
Well, we can try to revive the marriage. Yeah?
Never go back. That's what they say.
Mommy and Daddy are going away to a hotel for the weekend.
Maybe we can only work at a range of 3,000 miles.
I've always thought, Andy, the further physically we were apart, the better we were able to work together.
So we'll see. So if you're an Edinburgh Buglers, come to A, my show at 4:25 in the afternoon, and Political Animal Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday next week, and Monday with only me and not John. And, see whether there are diamonds in the dung heap still.
Yeah, see if these two repelling magnets can do it.
Until next week, goodbye, Buglers. Goodbye.
Farewell!